Good morning. This is your host, Fufu, also known as Divine.
And your co-host, Voodoo, also known as Kenya.
Today, you're tuning into True Crime Thursday, and the case we'll be covering is the infamous case of the girl in the box, or the kidnapping of Colleen Stan. And here's a little rundown on the case. So Colleen J. Stan was born on December 31st, 1956, in Eugene, Oregon. And on May 1977, when she was 20 years old, Colleen Stan was hitchhiking from her hometown of Eugene, Oregon, to her friend's home in Northern California for a birthday party. Cameron and Janice Hooker, a married couple with a kid, picked her up and kidnapped her and held her hostage under their bed from the years of 1977 to 1984 for about 4 years. And the reason why she's known as the girl in the box is because she was held under their bed in a box in which she was tortured in, and in which they did heinous things to her. So here we go with the story. In 1977, 20-year-old Colleen Stan was hitchhiking from her hometown of Eugene, Oregon to Northern California. She considered herself an expert hitchhiker, and on that day in May, she had already turned down two rides. And mind you, back then in the 1970s and earlier on and a bit after, hitchhiking was modern-day Uber or Lyft, so it was one of the most safe, not safest, but it was one of the most popular ways of getting around if you didn't have a car of your own or needed to get someplace. And however, when a blue van pulled over in Red Cliff, California, Stan saw that it was being driven by a man, and his wife was in the passenger seat and a baby in the back seat. Deeming the young couple and their child a safe ride, Stan got in. Sadly, she had no idea what she was in for. This is the horrifying story of how Colleen Stan became the girl in the box. The man was 23-year-old Cameron Hooker, and his wife was 19-year-old Janice Hooker. As it turned out, they had been actively looking for a hitchhiker to kidnap. Cameron, a lumber mill worker, had intense bondage fantasies. Until they captured Colleen Stan, he had been using his wife, Janice, to fulfill his fantasies. Shortly after Stan got into the van, Cameron veered off the road and into a remote area. That's when he held a knife to her neck and forced her into a head box. The weighed 20 pounds. 20 pounds is a lot. It's extremely heavy. I can barely lift 20. And that's, yeah. The box, which only confined her head, blocking out sound and light around her and prevent the flow of fresh air. The car eventually drove to a house where Colleen Stan was led downstairs to a cellar and subjected to horrifying forms of torture. The girl in the box was tied to the ceiling by her wrists and then beaten, electrocuted, whipped, and burned. Initially, the demented couple had an agreement that concluded Cameron wasn't allowed to engage in sexual activities with Stan. Instead, she was forced to watch the couple have sex. After they abused her later on, this agreement would change, and Cameron started incorporating rape into the forms of torture. When the family moved into a mobile home, Colleen Stan was kept in a coffin-like wooden box underneath the hooker's bed for up to 23 hours a day, hence Stan now being known as the girl in the box. The couple had two young daughters who didn't realize Stan was being kept under her will and didn't even know that she was living in the house. For an hour or two a day, the girl in the box would clean and babysit the children. Any time I was taken out of the box, I never knew what to expect. Fear of the unknown was always with me as I was kept in the dark both physically and mentally, said Stan. Although she was subjected to regular beatings and rape, Stan didn't consider her torture to be the worst aspect of her confinement. What terrified her even more was Cameron's claims that he was a member of a satanic organization called The Company. She was told that The Company was a powerful organization who watched over her and had her family's home bugged. More than anything, Stan feared an escape attempt would cause Company to harm her family. So the girl in the box remained in captivity and even signed a contract stating that she was their slave. By complying with Cameron and his wishes, Stan continuously earned more and more freedom. She was allowed to work in the garden and go for jogs. She was even allowed to visit her family. Cameron accompanied her and she said he was her boyfriend. Her family took a happy looking photograph of the pair, but her lack of communication and money made them believe she was in a cult. However, they didn't want to pressure her as they were scared it would cause her to disappear for good. Stan's fear of the company stopped her from escaping or revealing any information to her family. Colleen Stan was kept captive for 7 years from 1977 to 1984. Towards the end of that seven-year span, Cameron stated that he wanted Stan as a second wife. That didn't bode well for Janice Hooker. Janice had confessed that Cameron tortured and brainwashed her since they first started dating each other, and that she had developed denial techniques and compartmentalized the aspect of her life. After this turning point, Janice revealed that Stan that Cameron was not part of the company and helped her escape. In the beginning, Janice asked Stan not to say anything, convinced that her husband would be rehabilitated when she realized he was unsavable. Janice reported her husband to the police. Cameron Hooker was charged with sexual assault and kidnapped using a knife. At the trial, Janice testified against him for full immunity. Colleen Stan's experience was described as unparalleled in FBI history. Cameron Hooker was found guilty and given a consecutive terms totaling 104-year sentence. In 2015, he was denied parole. It will be a minimum of 15 more years before he's eligible for parole. Colleen suffered chronic back and shoulder pain as a result of her confinement. She was, when she returned home, she received an extensive therapy, eventually marrying and having a daughter of her own. She joined an organized organization committed to helping her abused women and earn a degree in accounting. Colleen Stan and Janice Hooker both changed their names and continue to reside in California. However, they do not communicate with one another. In regards to her resilience, during these excruciating years in captivity, Stan told reporters, "I learned I could go anywhere in my mind." In a similar vein to Janice's compartmentalization, said Stan. Stan said, "You just remove yourself from the real situation going on and you go somewhere else." A television film of Stan's story called The Girl in the Box was made in 2006, along with a few other books and more films. I'm glad that Cameron is in jail because he's just a shitty person. And, I feel like he... What's that word? He was a predator because his wife was 19. He was 23. Mm-hmm. I think she might have like some Stockholm syndrome of some sort or something.
Yeah. Like she was 19. She could be a freshman in college.
And it's 4 years, but it's like,
yeah,
23 and 19 is just crazy. And again, she said that, he would do the bondage fantasies that he had, and they're bad. They're like psychopathic level. So he did it to her first, and she was sick of it. Of course she was. I think she might have also been raped. Probably. As well.
Yeah, because I mean, she might have wanted to have the children, but there's also a possibility that yeah, was like something that he wanted.
I feel like he manipulated her to a point of no return.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that she later on turned on him, even though it was because she wanted him for herself in a way, because she didn't want him having sex with anyone else but her. But I'm just glad that he turned on her. He turned on him. Mm-hmm. And I just feel really, really bad for Colleen because what's that confinement thing? When you're in jail, solitary confinement is usually anywhere from 22 to 24 hours, and she was in for 24 hours and she couldn't see the sun, really hear anything or get fresh air,
like vision and hearing and things.
And she had a lot of injuries when she got out, and once, like, in the 1 hour that she was allowed to be out, she was forced to watch and take care of their kids while they were out doing God knows what. And it's a crazy case. It's crazy. All right, that was it for the first case. I'm glad that she's in a better place now and she got out. Because that's for 7 years being under a box, and then that's just crazy. Her life is. I hope she's
Doing a lot better now.
a lot better. And I hope that she got her bag from the movies and books that were all written about her, because it's her life. She suffered through all of that. Yeah. The next case we're going to be covering is the Ariel Castro kidnappings, and it's the victims were Michelle Knight, Amanda Berry, and Georgina Gina De Jesus. And it takes place in Cleveland, Ohio. And it went on from August 23rd, 2002 to May 6th, 2013. So it's really recent. Let's get on with the case. Between 2002 and 2004, Ariel Castro kidnapped Michelle Knight, Amanda Berry, and Georgina De Jesus from the streets of Cleveland, Ohio, and later held them captive in his home of 2207 Seymour Avenue in the city's Tremont neighborhood. All three girls were imprisoned at Castro's home until 2013, when Berry successfully escaped with her 6-year-old daughter, to whom she had given birth while imprisoned, and contacted the police. Police refused. Police rescued Knight and De Jesus and arrested Castro hours later. Castro was charged with 4 counts of kidnapping and 3 counts of rape. He pleaded guilty to 937 criminal counts of rape, kidnapping, and aggravated murder as part of a plea bargain. He was sentenced to life imprisonment plus 1,000 years in prison without the possibility of parole. 1 month into his life sentence, Castro committed suicide by hanging himself with bed sheets in his prison cell. I just have to say, excuse my French, but he's a bitch. Like, he's a pussy. Like, after you kidnapped, raped, murdered their kids that you raped them to get, and just assaulted them and attempted to kill them, might I add, you were too pussy to put up or deal with it, and you just chose the easy way out, and that was to kill yourself.
Right.
Like, he deserved
Like, it
the
was
worst of the
1 month.
worst. Yeah.
1 month. It wasn't even like a year.
That's the one thing that I don't really get about serial killers, or like people who just choose to kill sometimes. It's like there's one half that are like, okay, they have no choice but to die, because they have what's that sentencing? Death
Yeah, definitely.
sentence. But then it's like, if you're given life in prison, yeah, that's you're gonna be stuck thinking about all the things that you've done to your victims. And there are some that just live with it, and they are terrible people as well. But the ones that I hate more than anything are the ones who choose the easy way out, and that is to kill themselves. And I feel like prisons themselves should do a better job at, like, they should put them in a room where there's nothing where th that they could use to possibly kill themselves with. Because they need to
Feel something
feel, or just they need
to think.
to just look back at life and see just how messed up they were, and see how much they've messed up people for their own self pleasure. And I don't like that. Back to the story. Ariel Castro was born in Dewey, Yoako, Puerto Rico, the son of Pedro Castro and Lillian Rodriguez. His parents divorced when he was a child, and he moves to mainland United States with his mother and three full siblings. They lived in Reading, Pennsylvania, before settling in Cleveland, Ohio, where Castro's father and other family members were living. Castro had 9 siblings, both full and half, and graduated from Cleveland Lincoln West High School in 1979. Castro met his girlfriend, Grimilda Figueroa, when his family moved into a house across the street from hers in the 1980s. Castro and Figueroa originally lived with both sets of their parents, but moved into their own homes at 2207 Seymour Avenue, located in Cleveland's Tremont neighborhood. I think it's like 2-3 stories, the house, I believe. I forget. In 1992. Their homes was a two-story, 1,400 square feet. That's kind of small. Four-bedroom, one-bed, one-bathroom house with a 760 square feet unfinished basement built in 1890 and remodeled in 1956. According to Figueroa's sister, Elda Caraballo, she said that all hell started breaking loose when the couple moved into their new home. Caraballo claimed that Castro beat Figueroa, breaking her nose, ribs, and arms, and causing a blood clot in her brain that resulted in an inoperable tumor. She also threw her down a flight. He also threw her down a flight of stairs, cracking her skull. In 1993, Castro was arrested for domestic violence, but was not indicted by a grand jury. In 1996, Figueroa moved out of the house and secured custody of her 4 children. Police assisted in the move and detained Castro, but they did not press charges. Castro continued to threaten and attack Figueroa after she left him. According to Caraballo, Figueroa filed charges in 2005 in Cuyahoga County Domestic Relations Court, accusing Castro of inflicting multiple severe injuries of her and of frequently abducting their daughters. The court granted for a temporary restraining order against Castro, but it was dismissed a few months later. Figueroa died in 2012 due to complications from her brain tumor. Friends and relatives gathered on Denison Avenue on April 29th, 2012 for memorial services in her honor. I don't like cops. Like, in every single true crime story that I've heard, they never do anything until it's too late.
Like, if you hear, like, I think if you're, like, being, like, hurt, you should go to them and, like, show them, like, what's happening.
But even when that happens, they don't.
Like, yeah. Your job is to protect the community, and if someone is being hurt, you need to stop it before.
Yeah.
More people die, and there's blood on your hands as well.
Like, there's taxpayers' money going towards you guys who...
Your job. Like,
they pled to serve and help the community, but what help are they giving when they just ignore all the calls for help, especially with rape victims or assault victims or domestic violence victims? They never do anything until it's too late, and it's sickening.
And then they're like, oh, oops.
They need better training, and even then, they need to do their jobs better, because you're never really doing their jobs yet. The reason why there's a lot of true crime cases to begin with is because most of the times, cops just let the people go, not the victims, they let the perpetrators go. Like, look at like Jeffrey Dahmer, they let him go. Ted Bundy, he looked nice, so they let him go. It's crazy. It's just wild. I'm sorry, back to the case. Before his arrest at age 52, Castro worked as a bus driver for the Cleveland Metropolitan School District until he was fired for bad judgment, including making an illegal U-turn with children on his bus, using his bus to do grocery shopping, leaving a child on the bus while he went out for lunch, and leaving the bus unattended while he took a nap at home. He was earning $18.91 per hour when he was discharged.
That's more than I make.
At the time of his arrest, Castro's new home was in foreclosure, as it should be, after 3 years of unpaid real estate taxes. Castro kidnapped his victims by offering them a ride. He drove each of his each to his home at 2207 Seymour Avenue, lured them inside, took them to the basement that was yet again unfinished, as we disclosed before, and restrained them. Here's Michelle Knight's story. So Michelle Knight was born on April 23rd, 1981, disappeared on August 23rd, 2002. After leaving a cousin's house, she was 21 years old at the time. On the day of her disappearance, she was scheduled to appear in court for a child custody case involving her son Joey, who was in the custody of the state. Following Knight's rescue, police acknowledged that the limited resources had been spent on investigating her disappearance in part because she was an adult. Authorities believed that she had ran away voluntarily due to anger over losing custody of her son. According to Cleveland Deputy Police Chief Ed Tomba, she was the focus of very few tips. Some criticized her subsequent removal from the National Crime Information Center database 15 months after she disappeared, which made her largely unknown prior to her rescue. The Cleveland Division of Police, CUDP, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, maintained that her inclusion or exclusion had no bearing on her rescue. And that's also the thing that I've noticed too, is like a lot of the cases that I've seen and heard of in the past, I'd say 8 years-ish, it's when it's adults, the cops just throw it to the side. Because it's like, oh, they did that by themselves. Or if it's a teenager, especially when it's a teenager, it's always, oh, well, do they have any history of running away? I understand why they say that, because like, yeah, okay, maybe they're gone for the date, but a mother's intuition, a father's intuition is never really wrong.
3 days, and they haven't said something, that means something's up. That doesn't mean, oh, they're going to come back, or they're just choosing to not answer the phone.
Yeah.
Like, if they could answer the phone, they would answer the phone.
Not all the time, which is also sad, because it's disgusting. And the United States sucks in so many ways, but their justice system is one of the most disgusting ones I've seen in my entire life and even heard of when compared to like other countries. But I would say they do better than some other countries, which is good and appreciated. But they definitely could do better with all the money that's put into it. And the next victim, Amanda Berry, was born Amanda Marie Berry on April 22nd, 1986. She disappeared or was kidnapped on April 21st, 2003, the day before her 17th birthday. She was last heard from around 8 p.m. when she called her sister to tell her that she was getting a ride home from her job at a Burger King at West 110th Street and Lorraine Avenue. The FBI initially considered her a runaway until a week after she disappeared, when an unidentified male using her cell phone to call her mother said, "I have Amanda, she's fine, and will be coming home in a couple of days." Berry was featured in a 2004 segment of Fox's America's Most Wanted, re-aired in 2005 and 2006, which linked her to Gina De Jesus, the next victim we'll be talking about, who by that point had also gone missing in Cleveland. Berry and De Jesus were profiled on the Orphan Oprah Winfrey show and the Montel Williams show, where a self-proclaimed psychic, Sylvia Brown, told Berry's mother, Lawana Miller, in November 2004 that her daughter was dead and that she was in water. The pronouncement devastated her mother, causing her to take down pictures and give away Berry's computer. However, Miller continued to search for Berry before dying from heart failure in early March 2006. Later that year, on December 25th, 2006, Berry gave birth to a daughter. DNA evidence has confirmed that Castro was the father of the child. Robert Wolford was a prison inmate who lived in Tremont, and he claimed in July 2012 that he had information about the location of Barry's body. He led police to an empty lot in Cleveland's West Side, where they conducted a fruitless search. He was sentenced in January 2013 to 4.5 years in prison for obstruction of justice, making false reports, and making a false alarm. I hate psychics,
mm-hmm.
especially TV psychics. I hate how they always go for the most vulnerable people, and they always just try and drain their money. Like, I don't. They need to be arrested as well. I feel like if I get that you have the right to freedom of speech or whatever, but I hate them so much. Oh my God. The other victim, Gina De Jesus, or Georgina, also known as Gina Lynn De Jesus, was born February 13th, 1990, went missing on April 2nd, 2004, at age 14. She was last seen at a payphone around 3 p.m. while on the way home from her middle school at West 105th Street and Lorraine Avenue. At the time, she was friends with Castro's daughter, Arlene, shortly before Gina disappeared. She and Arlene had called Arlene's mother, Grimilda, Grimilda Figueroa, and for permission to have a sleepover at Jesus' house, but Figueroa replied that they cannot, and the two girls parted ways. Arlene was the last person to see De Jesus before her disappearance. When I first heard of this story, my heart melted for Gina, because she was friends with her future perpetrator, rapist. She was friends with his kid, so she trusted him in a way, because she's like, oh, it's my friend's parent, I can trust them. Because you don't, if you're friends with someone, you just trust them, and you would assume that they have the best interest for you. But what also killed me was that Arlene, his daughter, didn't know until
she's also 14.
They keep on getting younger and younger and younger as time progresses for the kidnappings. But also, it's like, what was going on in your mind to go, oh, I need to kidnap my daughter's friend and do all these crazy things to her? I hate him so much, and he's ugly as hell too. So I'm like, it's always, ugh, he's ugly inside and out, and that's just. De Jesus was under the impression that Castro was picking her up to drop her off at home, and she trusted Castro because she was friends with his teenage daughter. No one witnessed her abduction, and an Amber Alert was not issued, which angered her father.
That would anger me too.
It would anger anybody, because I mean, she's 14. I get, yeah, some kids run away from home, but then again, she's 14.
Mm-hmm.
She just turned into a teenager, not even
like a year ago.
Yeah, he said in 2006, the Amber Alert should work for any missing child. Whether it's an abduction or a runaway, a child needs to be found. We need to change this law. A year after the Jesus' disappearance, the FBI released a composite sketch and description of a male suspect described as Latino, 25 to 35 years old, years of age, 5'10", 168 to 185 pounds, with green eyes, a goatee, and possibly a pencil-thin beard. According to court records, Castro was 5'7", 179 pounds, with brown eyes and a goatee. De Jesus was under the impression, oh, I already read that part, I apologize. A year after De Jesus' disappearance, I read that part as well, didn't I? De Jesus was featured in America's Most Wanted segments with links, which linked her to Barry. The disappearances received regular media attention in 2012. While the family held public vigils, Castro attended at least two of these vigils, reportedly participated in a search party, and tried to get close to the De Jesus family. Castro's son, Anthony, was a journalism student in 2004, and he interviewed De Jesus' mother for an article about the disappearance in the Plain Press newspaper. Police kept the investigation open and offered a $25,000 reward for information. According to Castro's uncle, his family knew the De Jesus family and had lived in the same neighborhood. Castro falsely claimed that he was not aware that De Jesus was a member of that family when he abducted her.
Now, how do you not know that? If you are sitting with your daughter's best friend, you know who that is.
Yeah.
And also with the whole,
lived in the same neighborhood.
Right, like.
And I mean, it did say that it was falsely.
Why would he go to like the vigils and stuff?
Oh, a lot of
like he would
no a lot of him? A lot of what's it called, serial killers, or what are the people, the bad people called who do the crimes, criminals, a lot of criminals tend to go back to the scene of the scene in which the events took place, or to like they tend to go on the media or the vigils in this case to seem like they're just innocent civilians, or they were trying to help, or just to not seem suspicious. But then again, a lot of them do that, so it itself is suspicious.
Also, it's really sad that his son had no idea what was happening, because he's a journalist, so he could have like
he would have
found them if he had known.
Yeah,
there was even like if he had even heard like a muffled scream.
I mean, but then again, there were like the son didn't really grow up with the dad, because the mom split up, then she died because of the complications due to the abuse that he inflicted on her. Mm. And that's just so sad. Upon being kidnapped, Castro took Michelle Knight to the upper floor of his house, tied her hands and feet together, and pulled her up using her hands, feet, and neck. He left her there for 3 days without food. Prosecutors at Castro's sentencing wrote that diaries kept by the victim speak of forceful sexual conduct, of being locked in a dark room, of anticipating the next session of abuse, of the dreams of someday escaping and being reunited with family, of being chained to a wall, of being held with, like a prisoner of war, of missing the lives they had once lived, of emotional abuse, of his threats to kill, being treated like an animal, of continuous abuse, and of desiring freedom. The women were kept in locked bedrooms where they were forced to use plastic toilets and were emptied frequently. They were fed one meal a day and allowed to shower twice a week at most. Knight told police that Castro had impregnated her at least 5 times and had induced miscarriages each time through beatings, hitting her with dumbbells, punching her, and slamming her against walls. He also starved her. Knight's grandmother told reporters that she would require facial reconstruction surgery due to the beatings that she had endured and had lost hearing in one ear. At one point, Knight had a pet dog while in captivity, but Castro killed it by snapping its neck after it bit him while trying to protect Knight. De Jesus told law enforcement that she was raped, but did not believe that she was ever impregnated. On Christmas Day 2006, Castro allegedly ordered Knight to assist in the birth of Barry's child, which took place in a small inflatable swimming pool, and threatened to kill her if the baby did not survive. At one point, the baby stopped breathing, but Knight was able to resuscitate her. Castro occasionally took Barry's daughter out of the house, including a visit to his mother. She called him Daddy, and Castro's mother, grandmother. In 2013, he showed one of his adult daughters a picture of the child and said that she was his girlfriend's daughter from a previous relationship. He had told others that she was his granddaughter. Barry taught her daughter how to read and write. According to a statement from CDP, officers visited Castro's home only once following the kidnappings to discuss an unrelated incident. Castro did not disappear to the home and at a time and was later interviewed elsewhere. Neighbors claimed to have called the police about suspicious activities observed at the house. But police have said that they have no record of any such calls. Castro's son, Anthony, reported that there were certain areas in the house that were locked and inaccessible. He also mentioned an occasion 3 weeks before the woman's escaped when Castro asked him if Barry would ever be found. Anthony said that he told Castro that Barry was likely dead, to which Castro responded, "Really? You think so?" NBC affiliate WKYC reported that Castro recalled each of the three abductions in great detail during his interrogation and indicated that they were unplanned crimes of opportunity, according to WKYC's sources. Castro did not have an exit plan and believed that he would eventually be caught. He referred to himself as cold-blooded and a sex addict. Police found a suicide note in his house in which he discussed the abductions and wrote that his money and possessions should be given to the kidnapped woman if he were caught. On May 6, 2013, Barry was finally able to make contact with Castro's neighbors, leading her to escape with her six-year-old daughter and the rescue of the Jesus and Knight by authorities. According to police, Castro had left the house the day and Barry realized that he failed to lock the big inside door. Although the exterior storm door was bolted, she did not attempt to break through the outer door because she thought that Castro was testing her. According to police report previously, Castro had tested the woman by leaving the house partially unlocked and exits unsecured. If they attempted to escape, he beat them. Instead, Barry screamed for help when she saw neighbors through the screen. Neighbor Angel Cordero responded to the screaming, but was unable to communicate with Barry because she spoke little English. Neighbor Charles Ramsey joined Cordero to Eva House's front door during the rescue. They kicked a hole through the bottom of the storm door and Barry crawled through. Carrying her daughter, Ramsey said that Barry told him that she and her child were being kept inside the house against her will. Upon being freed, she went to the house of another Spanish-speaking neighbor and with Ramsey's assistance called 911 saying, "Help me, I've been kidnapped and I've been missing for 10 years and I'm here, I'm free now." Responding police officers Anthony Espada, Michael Tracy, and Barbara Johnson enter Castro's home. They walk through an upstairs hallway with guns drawn, announcing themselves as CDP. After peeking out from a slightly open bedroom door, Knight entered the hallway and leaped into the officer's arms, repeatedly saying, "You saved me." Soon afterwards, the Jesus were entered the hallway from another room. Knight and the Jesus walked out of the house, and all three women plus a child were taken to Metro Health Medical Center. Barry and the Jesus were released from the hospital the next day, and Knight was discharged. Four days after, on May 10th, Castro was arrested on May 6, 2013. He was charged with 4 counts of kidnapping and 3 counts of rape which carry prison sentences of 10 years to life in Ohio. Two of Castro's brothers, Pedro and O'Neill, were also initially taken into custody but were released on May 9th after police announced that they had no involvement in the kidnappings. The charges against the two brothers were dropped. Castro made his first court appearance at the Cleveland Municipal Court on May 9th, where bail was set to $2 million per kidnapping charge. So that's $6 million, adding to a total of $8 million, prosecutors intended to seek the death penalty against Castro. Additional charges were reported to be pending, including aggravated murder for intentional induction of miscarriages, attempted murder, assault, a charge for each instance of rape, and a kidnapping charge for each day each captive was held. On May 14th, Castro's attorney said he would plead not guilty to all charges of indicted
Indicted.
of if in the if indicted for kidnapping and rape. A Cuyahoga County and jury, true bill of indictments against Castro on June 7th. It contained 329 counts, including two counts of aggravated murder under different sections of the Ohio Criminal Code, for his roles in the termination of one of the women's pregnancies. The indictments covered only for the period of August 2002 and February 2007. Or through February 2007, the county prosecutor Timothy J. McGinty stated that the investigation was ongoing, and that any further findings would be presented to the grand jury. McGinty said that pursuing a death penalty specifications will be considered following completion of indictment proceedings. After answering a not guilty plea for Castro on June 12th, one of his attorneys, Craig Weintraub, said that although some of the charges against Castro were indisputable, it is our hope that we can continue to work towards a resolution to avoid having unnecessary trials about aggravated murder and death penalty, he noted. We are very serious to the emotional strain and impact that a trial would have on the women, their families, and this community. Castro was found competent to stand trial on July 3rd. On July 12th, a Cuyahoga County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment for the remainder of the period after February 2007. It brought the total of 977 counts, 512 counts of kidnapping, 448 of rape, 7 of gross sexual imposition, 6 of felonious assault, 3 of child endangerment, 2 of aggravated murder, and 1 of possession of criminal tools. On July 17th, Castro pleaded not guilty to the expanded indictment. He faced death penalty by lethal injection if convicted on all charges. Castro pleaded guilty on July 26th to 937 of the 977 charges against him, including charges of kidnapping, rape, aggravated murder, as a part of the plea bargain, which called for consecutive sentences of life in prison plus 1,000 years, all without parole. Under the plea deal, Castro forfeited his right to appeal and could not profit in any way due to his crimes. He also forfeited his assets, including his Seymour Avenue house, which prosecutors said will be demolished. Castro was told by Cuyahoga County Common Pleas Court Judge Michael Rosso, "You will not be getting out if that's clear. Is that clear?" To which Castro responded, "I do understand that, Your Honor." Castro also made comments about his addiction to pornography and sexual problems, but was cut off by Judge Rosso, who said such issues could be discussed at the August 1st sentencing hearing. A law firm representing Barry DeJesus and Knight released a statement that the three women were relieved by today's plea. They were satisfied by the resolution to the case and were looking forward to having these legal proceedings drawn to a final close in the near future. At the sentencing hearing of August 1st, Castro was sentenced to a consecutive life term in prison, plus 1,000 years, all without any possibility of parole, and was fined $100,000. The court forfeited all of his properties and assets to the Cuyahoga County government. Before sentencing, Castro addressed the court for nearly 20 minutes, in which he said he was a good person and not a monster, but that he was addicted to sex and pornography and had practiced the art of masturbation from a young age. He claimed that he had never beaten or tortured the women, and insisted that most of the sex he had with them was consensual. He shifted between apologizing and blaming the FBI for failing to catch him, as well as blaming his victims themselves for getting in the car with a stranger, along with insisting to the court that when he had sex with them, he discovered they were not virgins. He would alternately shift back into apologetic comments, saying, I hope they can find in their heart to forgive me. Because we had a lot of harmony going on in the house. The sentencing judge also heard from Knight's family members of Barry. From Knight and family members of Barry and De Jesus, Knight told Castro, "You took 11 years of my life away. I spent 11 years in hell. Now your hell is just beginning. I will overcome all of that that has happened, but you will face hell for eternity. I will live on. You will die a little every day as you think of the 11 years of atrocities you inflicted on us. I can forgive you, but I'll never forget." Knight, Barry, and De Jesus released a video statement on July 9th, 2013, thanking the public for their support. An attorney for Barry and De Jesus said that the women still have a strong desire for privacy and did not wish to speak to the media about their ordeal. The Cleveland Courage Fund is a bank accounting set up to help the women in their transition to independent life, which High Collective collected approximately $1.5 million at the time of the video's release. Before Barry's disappearance, her grandfather had promised to give her a classical Chevrolet Monte Carlo, built in the year when she was born. He built a car after her kidnapping in case she was still alive. He still had it for her when she was released, although it was in need of restoration from having been unused. Several automotive shops offered to perform the restoration free. Knight discussed some of her ordeals in an interview with the People magazine 1 year after her release, as well as her life leading up to her abduction. Since her rescue, she legally changed her name and began to get several tattoos as her way of coping with the healing process. She also revealed that her son was adopted by his foster parents while she was in captivity and that she wanted to see him, but she doesn't want to bring him into the ordeal, which she had to deal with, and planned to see him after he became an adult. She planned to open a restaurant and dreamed of getting married, which she did in 2016, and hopes to adopt the children. As her years of abuse and torture have made it unlikely for her to be able to give birth, she also planned to reunite with Barry and De Jesus in the future, but began focusing on getting her own life back on track. Barry and De Jesus received honorable diplomas from John Marshall High School in 2015. In an interview with WKYC, De Jesus said that she's currently volunteering for the Amber Alert Committee, offering comfort to families of abducted children. She remains in touch with Barry and her family. In February 2017, Barry joined staff of Fox affiliate WJW in Cleveland, where she hosts short recurring segments in which she reports missing persons cases in order to help families reunite with missing family members. In April 2019, Barry reunited with Charles Ramsey, 6 years since he rescued her. At the interview that was broadcasting on WJW, as part of the plea bargain, the house where Castro had lived and held the woman captive was demolished on August 7, 2013. Knight was present, and handed out yellow balloons to specters, which she was representing missing children. The balloons were released before De Jesus' aunt began the demolition in a swing of crane. The house has been completely blurred out of the street view on Google Maps. Castro was found hanging from his bed sheets in his detention cell at the Correctional Reception Center in Orient, Ohio, on the evening of September 3rd, 2013. 1 month into his life sentence, he was 53 at the time of his death. Prison staff performed CPR to him before he was taken to the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center in Columbus, where he was pronounced dead shortly after. The following day, Franklin County Coroner Jan Gorniak announced that a preliminary autopsy had found the cause of Castro's death to be suicide by hanging. He was later cremated on October 10th, 2013. The Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction released a report which suggested that Castro may have died accidentally from autoerotic asphyxiation. rather than suicide. Gorniak rejected the possibility setting by her ruling of suicide. The report also said the two prison guards had falsified logs documenting their observation of Castro hours before he was found dead. He was not on suicide watch at the time of his death, but had been subjected to routine checks every 30 minutes due to his notoriety. A consultant's report was released on December 3rd and officially concluded that all available evidence pointed to suicide, including the shrine-like arrangement of family pictures and a Bible in Castro's cell, an increasing tone of frustration in the prison journal, and the reality of spending the rest of his life in prison while subject to constant harassment. The Ohio State Highway Patrol also reviewed the case and rehashed the same conclusion.
That was interesting.
It was heavy.
Yeah.
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 It's, yeah.
I found it very interesting that it was like, it kept getting younger, the people he was kidnapping.
Yeah.
Like and a 14-year-old. And he was what, like 50? 40?
He was 54 when he died, yeah.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
It is disgusting.
And the guards that were in charge of, the ones that were in charge of watching him, and they just, I will never, if I ever go missing, or I wouldn't trust the cops, because one, I'm black and in America, so it's like if I,
I'm not American,
and I'm not even American to begin with, so if I ever do go missing, then I mean, they're not going to put in their effort to look for me, no matter how many resources is really put in.
Yeah.
Because look at, there was a case a while ago, I forgot her name, but rest in peace. It was her death anniversary a while ago. But I think it was in 2020, if not 2021, but she was kidnapped and murdered by her boyfriend. It was something Petro, I think, I forgot. But like, as soon as she was reported missing, like, all forces went towards her. Like, everybody helped her out. But not even long after, a black woman was found murdered and whatever, and they barely even tried looking into her case. They just kind of put it to the side. So I wouldn't trust cops if I ever went missing or got murdered or kidnapped or whatever, or whatnot. And the last and final case for True Crime Thursday is going to be on the kidnapping and murder of Amber Hagerman's, the girl who inspired the Amber Alerts. And with that, Harvey wouldn't have Amber Alerts. And even 26 years after her, the whole case, her killer has yet to be found or caught. I'll pass it on to Kenya.
So, Arlington, Texas, the kidnapping and brutal murder of a 9-year-old Texas girl is what has inspired the Amber Alert system. Her name is Amber Hagerman, and 26 years after she was kidnapped and murdered, her killer still hasn't been caught. Since it was created in 1996, the system has contributed to the rescue of more than 1,000 children. So, the story. Amber Hagerman, 9, was riding her bicycle in a parking lot of an abandoned grocery store in Arlington, Texas, on January 13, 1996, when she was kidnapped. A witness told police he saw a man get out of a black pickup truck, grab her off her bicycle, and force her into his truck as she kicked and screamed. The driver fled the scene with Amber. 4 days later, a man walking his dog found Amber's body in a creek about 4 miles from where she was abducted. Autopsy results revealed she had died from cut wounds to the neck, according to AP. As of January of last year, police have received and investigated more than 7,000 tips related to the case. I miss her every day, and she's just so full of life, and I want to know why her? She was only a little girl, Amber's mother, Donna Williams, said last year. Police said there is limited evidence in the case, but they hope that new DNA technologies can help them catch the killer. I would love to be able to give Donna and Ricky and the rest of the members of their family the answer to the question that they would like to know. And of course, that is who did this to Amber and bring this person to justice. Sergeant Ben Lopez with the Arlington Police Department said last year. what police know about the suspect. Police believe the suspect is a white or Hispanic man who was in his 20s to 30s in 1996. He is believed to be shorter than 6 feet and had a medium build and brown or black hair. He had a black 1980s or 1990s full-size fleet side pickup truck with a short wheelbase, single cab, and a clear rear window. There is no chrome or striping and no visible damage to the truck. I want to make clear here today that we believe this case will get solved. We believe there's no way the killer in this case could have committed the crime in the manner that they did without someone seeing, hearing, or having some knowledge of what happened. Detective Grant Gilden with Arlington Police Department. The Amber Alert System created in 1996. Amber's death inspired Diane Simone from Dallas, Texas to call an area radio station and ask if local broadcasters could team up with police to get information out immediately following a child abduction, according to NBC News. That could change thousands of lives. Later that year, Dallas-Fort Worth broadcasts established a coordinated system with police so they could warn the public when a child was kidnapped and in danger. The alert has Amber's name but stands for America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response, also known as Amber. Other states and communities soon set up their own Amber plans as the idea spread across the nation. As of May 1, 2022, the Amber Alert program has contributed to the recovery of 1,114 children, and wireless emergency alerts have resulted in the rescue of 123 children. There are 82 Amber Alert plans throughout the nation. The plan is in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The system is used internationally in 31 countries. Criteria for issuing Amber Alerts. Each state has its own criteria for issuing these alerts. The PROTECT Act passed in 2003, which established the role of Amber Alert Coordinator within the Department of Justice. The department's guidance on criteria for issuing Amber Alerts is listed below. There is reasonable belief by law enforcement that an abduction has occurred. The law enforcement agency believes that the child is in imminent danger of serious bodily injury or death. There is enough descriptive information about the victim and the abduction for law enforcement to issue an Amber Alert to assist in the recovery of the child. The abduction is of a child aged 17 years or younger. The child's name and other critical data elements, including the child abduction flag, have been entered in the National Crime Information Center, NCIC, system.
Her case was really, it was touching. Not touching in a good way, but it was just, it's sad that she has, like, the killer hasn't been caught, because you'd think that with all of the advancements in technology and police equipment, like, they'd have a better lead or even find the killer with DNA advanced or something, but it's still, it's crazy. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I think it is crazy that, like, this was what, like, 26 years ago? That's almost like,
it's more than 2.5 decades. Yeah,
that's almost 30 years, and within 30 years we have gotten, like, computers,
like DNA
and DNA tests and a whole bunch of stuff that could potentially lead to that. Also, I'm confused as to what the neighbor was doing, because it said that there was a neighbor. It said a witness told police. I wonder, he should have gotten the license plate.
It was in 19.
I know, but don't they? 96. I thought they stole license plates.
They had license plates, but
They couldn't track them, I guess.
I think they could. It was 96, not 86 or something. But I feel like if you were in the center of it and just, like, if you witnessed a murder or a kidnapping, like, it's scary, not only for, especially for the person who was kidnapped, it's horrifying, but for you, it's like, oh, how can you help that person? And your first response when you're outside without a pen or a pencil or whatever, and they didn't have, like, the phones that we have, so they couldn't record anything. So it's like, how can you help the person?
Yeah.
They could describe the car to the cops, but then again,
there's a lot of those cars. That's just kind of annoying.
And I feel like the age for Amber Alert should be raised from 17 and younger to 8 to like,
to like 21. Maybe, because like 21 is like when.
I'd say 25. Because 21, you're still in college and you're still basically a kid in your head.
Yeah, that's true.
And you're still navigating life. 25, you're most likely out of college if you aren't doing like a graduate or anything degree.
Yeah.
And
because 17, that's a like junior or senior in high school.
Yeah.
But like 18 is also a senior in high school.
The Amber Alert's age needs to be raised. But I do like that it's helped. That even with the family's loss, that they've tried their best to help other people who have gone through similar, if not worse, events.
Mm-hmm.
Because a while ago in Clarkson, Georgia, there was a kid who was kidnapped. And an Amber Alert was issued, and that Amber Alert helped catch the kid, which is good. And a relief to the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's life. This we live in a weird, cruel world, and the justice system is there's limited justice in the justice system, which I don't like at all. And they pick and choose which cases basically to focus all their attention on, which is not helping. It's helping the ones that they're focusing on, but it's not really, really helping everybody. A lot of times, a lot of the cases that I've also heard, the cops were involved, if not the perpetrators in the cases, which is just terrible. Just disgusting. This episode has come to an end. Thank you so much for tuning in to Fufu and Voodoo. This was a heavy, heavy episode. Stay safe. Carry protective items with you.
Don't get into random people's cars.
If you ever go outside, or if you make sure that at least one to two people have your location that you really, really trust more than anything in the world. So that if anything does ever happen to you, they can track you if your phone isn't turned off or anything.
And learn some martial arts. It might help you.
Carry
pepper spray.
Some weapons with you. Just anything, be careful, because it's a cruel world out here, and it's terrible. It's disgusting.
And look behind you when you're walking.
Always be, whenever you're out in public, always be observant of your surroundings. Never let your guard down. No matter who or how much you trust that person, never let your guard down. Because there are a lot of cases as well where it was the family members or friends that were the perpetrators, which is just disgusting in itself. So stay safe and have a good day.